Thank you, choir and Rachel. Good morning again, everyone. In case you're wondering, there's water in that cup. The strangest question any law school student has asked me over the 30 years I have taught. I bring a cup of water to class every day, with a couple of allergy mints. And one day, in my 29th year of teaching, I had a student ask, "Professor Shelton, what's in the cup?" I said, "What do you think's in the cup?" Coffee, water, maybe later in the day, something else in a different cup, but not in this one. I appreciate you being here today and always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and offer some comments. It's going to be incredibly difficult for me to improve on what Abby said to the children. Listen and use kind words and develop it as a practice. But here we go. Have you ever heard anyone say, "We need to return to the purity of the earliest church," or maybe they call it the New Testament church? Maybe we don't hear that so often anymore, but I've heard that a lot in my life. And we still hear it from time to time. We've got to go back to the basics. If we could just get back to that earliest church, we could overcome problems and disagreements in our own. You know, some have tried this kind of model. They don't have a piano or an organ, as if that had anything whatsoever to following Jesus. My response is twofold to this return to the earliest church. Number one, what are you talking about? What earliest church? If you read the New Testament, there were early churches. Number two, why in the world would we want to return to those churches? They had all kinds of problems. They were factious. They were problem-filled churches. They were like many churches today. Indeed, most every church at some point in time. The earliest churches portrayed in the New Testament included, for example, what we sometimes call the Jerusalem church, which had some prominence as portrayed in the book of Acts. We also had a number of churches that Paul established or that he knew of through various sources, and indeed there were other missionaries that established local churches. Paul wrote his letters, a big chunk of our New Testament, in large part to address a multiplicity of divisiveness and other problematic issues, all which were far removed from the model that Jesus gave us with his life and what he taught us to be his followers, namely, to focus on love and justice and compassion for others. There are 27 books in the New Testament. What if we eliminated all of the books written at least in part to address serious disagreements among the congregants who received the letter or with their founders or leaders and to remind them of what's truly important? We'd have a shorter New Testament indeed, a very short one. I mean, they make these little New Testaments you can put in your pocket. Well, you could put that bad boy in any pocket of any clothing you own even the smallest ones, with just a cursory look. We'd eliminate a lot of the book of Acts, that's for sure. A big part of the book of Acts dealt with a serious controversy at the time, namely, whether a Gentile must become Jewish first in order to be a Christian. The book of Romans, which we'll focus on this morning, Paul didn't establish that church, but he was going to visit it. So he wrote an introduction of sorts, but he knew enough about the church to know they had problems, and he addressed them, and that's what we'll get to in part of what we read about from the book of Romans. 1 Corinthians would probably be the first thing we'd cut out. 1 Corinthians is just loaded with problematic issues and questions that this congregation that Paul established had for him. Among the controversies was one big one, factions which formed around certain leaders. My guy's better than yours. 2 Corinthians, lots of problems there, including just with the text of that book. It's probably three letters pieced together, and certainly includes a lot of problematic things that were going on early on. And then some of our real favorites, my goodness. Galatians, which where Paul dealt with false teachers, again related to this Jewish before Christian or not controversy. That plagued Paul, by the way. Colossians, one of my favorites, including that passage that I read that I go through every morning of my life when I walk or run or hike or do whatever else I feel like doing when it's dark outside and everyone else in their right mind, or perhaps I should take the else out and say everyone in their right mind is asleep. Paul talked about and addressed some issues related to false teachers, this time ones that taught rule following or worse yet, claim to have some kind of special knowledge that everyone didn't have. You had never met anyone like that, have you? They know something and have a perspective on it that's just perfect, and no one else does. Right. 1 Thessalonians, the earliest New Testament book. A lot of problems there, including speculation among some that Jesus was about to return again. In fact, the earliest books in the New Testament in terms of when they were written focused a bit on the expected, at that time, imminent return of Jesus. That's always puzzled me a bit, because he'd already returned. He was resurrected. They were, of course, thinking about another coming. It was such a problem in the Thessalonians church that some quit work. Why work? I'll just lay around in bed and wait for him to come. But there were others who worked to support them. And then one final one I'll mention, and we could spend the rest of the time on this, which we won't. One of my very favorite books in the entirety of the Bible, the book of James. The book of James is a real treasure. But obviously, when you read it, you get the impression that the recipients of this letter had a problem with the fact that some tended to placate the rich in various congregations, as opposed to prioritizing the needs of the poor. Well, with that quick exercise, that gets us to 19 books, and if we continued, we'd get to even fewer. Disagreements over faith issues have occurred throughout history, and that includes interfaith disagreements between faith traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, for example. Intra-faith issues within Christianity, for example. Interdenominational issues between denominations, which is a special kind of intra-faith disagreement. And then perhaps most prominently, intra-individual churches. Sometimes people get hot and bothered about issues, and sometimes the issues are important, but the hot and bothered part is not so good. And we can trace the history of arguments in our own tradition to the time of Jesus in history and his inner circle. For example, there were disagreements, and I'm sure you'll recall this, among his inner circle about who would have the highest places in the kingdom of God. Jesus responded by emphasizing the priority of humility over the desire to appear important. What's the antidote for problematic divisiveness in churches? Well, in large part, it's pretty simple. Abby's statement to the children, listen and be kind. Prioritize love, care, and respect. It includes certainly not taking ourselves too seriously. Rather, we should take, in a collective sense, the needs of others more seriously. And we should take very seriously the way we express differing views to one another and respect differences of opinion. The passage from Colossians 3 today is about as good a mission statement, I think, as one can find for a church, for a family, for a faith tradition. It's especially applicable to our tradition as Christians. Verses 12 and 14 collectively bring us a strong statement about our choices of intention and attitude that we should then exhibit and cultivate as habits, as a practice, if you will. As a paraphrase, as those who choose to follow God, we should intend and habitually live with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Above everything, we should love one another. Patience is a tough one. It's a real tough one, especially in times when people are disagreeing about things. In the context of differences of opinion, however, one thing that can oftentimes help, and this is part of practicing patience, is to develop the practice of pausing. Pause before you react or before you say something. Think of the consequences. And once you say it or do it, realize, unlike in an informal game of golf, you don't get a mulligan. In an informal game of golf, sometimes people will take a mulligan. They'll hit some shot off into the woods or something else, and they'll say, I'm hitting a mulligan and I'm playing it. They'll hit it and play it, and it's as if the other shot never happened. That's fine. That makes it more fun, at least for some people. But when you say or do something that hurts somebody, certainly you can do something about it, but it's not erased. So the pause in counting the cost is a good principle. But for the entirety of our history as Christians, there has been divisiveness in churches for any number of reasons and related to any number of issues, some of which are quite important, for sure. And with an open and calm perspective, isn't it a good thing to hear a different point of view and think about it and learn from it? It can be a very good thing. At times, however, the issues are really problematic, and sometimes all of us hold a little too tightly to overly strong opinions. I know I have at points in time, and I've regretted it. Let's recall as well that Jesus was a victim himself of others in power in his faith tradition in history. These powerful leaders who disagreed with him. And lest we forget, as some Christians seem to do at points in time, Jesus was Jewish. More particularly, he was a Jewish rabbi. The polarizations that he experienced during his lifetime, we can call those intra-faith disagreements. His accusers and opponents within the Jewish power structure of the day were unbending in their oppressive opinions about certain religious principles and practices. These included dietary matters and observance of the Sabbath and how that should be done. They did not respect Jesus's prioritizing the true heart of the Jewish law and prophets, which is all about seeking to be holy as God is holy. As we learn in Leviticus 19, one of the ethical highlights of the Old Testament. Through Moses, God told the people that he expected them to be holy. And then among other things, that chapter tells us to love our neighbor as ourself, but it goes beyond that. And the instruction is to love even the alien in our land. It's a powerful chapter for sure. Jesus's perspective changed the letter of his opponents' religious laws in various contexts, such as helping the sick, that is, working on the Sabbath. Dietary matters and observance of special days, as we'll see, were also among the issues that divided the early Roman church. So let's consider an example of many intra-early church divides that Paul addresses in Romans 14. In context, and unlike many of his other letters, speaking of pauses, Paul had not established that church, but he knew about it by reputation, and he knew that that church experienced some problems that other early churches did. Verse 1 in chapter 14 is powerful. Again, to paraphrase, welcome those who have a different opinion related to faith matters, but not for the purpose of quarreling. One of the divisive matters in the early Roman church related to dietary habits. Now, this isn't about, you know, someone's following one faddish diet and another something else, you know, diet you'd hear about from Oprah or something like this. The issues were different and they were serious at the time. We get some insight into this in 1 Corinthians 10, where there were also problems with dietary differences. It was more fully rooted in the fact that the meat bought in meat markets could have come from animals that were offered as sacrifices to idols. The meat eaters didn't think that was any big deal. To them, it was irrelevant because the idols were non-existent. But others chose to be vegetarian because they wanted to avoid any link whatsoever with pagan rituals and idols. The other two items noted in Romans 14 that incited conflict, division, and judgment of others were whether Christians should observe special days or festivals, and whether Christians should consume or abstain from alcohol. The actual divisive issues in our day and time, they differ, except perhaps in some conservative and rural congregations regarding the usage of alcohol. But the principles related to disagreements and priorities, they're the same. They're the same. Prayerfully developing faith-based opinion, that's a good thing to do. But not as a weapon, not as a weapon to judge or disrespect others that think differently. As Paul says a few verses beyond what we read, this is Romans 14, 22, again to paraphrase, the faith convictions and opinions that you have, keep them as your own convictions before God. Paul emphasizes in the entirety of the chapter that we should not use our own convictions to judge, disrespect, or harm someone else. In other words, how we treat people, how we treat others with different views, for example, is more important than our opinions on the issues themselves, or who might be right or correct. When people differ in viewpoints, they are both correct when they treat one another kindly. I chose as our gospel reading for today some of the last few words, as I mentioned, of Jesus on the cross. In his last few breaths, what was Jesus thinking about? Certainly not religious dogma. He was concerned with who was going to take care of his mother, as well as, I think, who was going to take care of his favorite disciple, perhaps, and best friend, John. So he said, as we read, "Woman, here is your son, and John, here is your mother." Some years ago, not that many, in April 2015, the Dalai Lama, a renowned Buddhist leader, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a prominent Christian leader, friends and both recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, they met for a week, and they discussed important inter and intra-faith issues. They focused on faith priorities that should unite people within and across faith traditions. Douglas Abrams, who is Jewish, attended and moderated their meetings and then wrote a book that chronicled their opinions along with his, which are excellent in and of themselves, in a book titled The Book of Joy, which includes ideas consistent ideas across the lines of Christianity, Buddhism, and Judaism. Chapter 4 of the book has a captivating title to me: Acceptance, the Only Place Where Change Can Begin. Both men advocate a wide perspective coupled with humility and not taking ourselves too seriously. Both of these great leaders have tremendous senses of humor, and they are oftentimes themselves the objects of their own humor. They don't take themselves too seriously. Further, regarding personal issues, such as, I mean, if we're talking about personal issues like an illness, dealing with aging, dealing with unexpected life changes, as well as group divisiveness, these great leaders encourage acceptance of our life and time in all its pain, imperfection, and beauty. Importantly, per these leaders, acceptance, it's the opposite of resignation and defeat. Sometimes people think of acceptance as just surrender, but that's not what they mean. Instead, they see acceptance of reality as a necessity and the only true place to start for change. Don't pretend something hasn't happened or changed, but make things better going forward. In a church or other faith-based group, also in a family, that is struggling with disputes or other problems, accepting what's going on and has already happened is a starting point to mitigate harm, such as hurt feelings, anger, harmful words, and misunderstandings. In our order of worship or bulletin, you'll note on one side there's this picture of the sun coming up over the mountains and reflected on a stream or lake. What a beautiful representation of the fact that we can accept the days that have gone before with all of their problems, and we can start anew and make it a new day with changes that are helpful and that lead us down a different path. It doesn't mean we discard our opinions at all, or the fact that some issues are quite important and should be talked about and advocated, but it has to do with elevating how we treat each other as our priority in word and action. It includes how we express our views on issues, as well as listening to others and respecting them. It means recognizing, as Paul encouraged the church members in Rome, that as followers of Jesus, we should focus on loving and caring for one another and on how much good we can do collectively for others. So I'm going to return to a paraphrase of Paul's words in Colossians because I like them so much. And they were spoken in the context at the time of sharp and judgmental divisiveness. As people who endeavor to follow the path that Jesus modeled and taught us, our priorities for intention and living should be compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, and above everything, and tying it all together, love. Amen. During our hymn of response, number 235, if you'd like to talk with me,